Research examines the dark past behind a natural state tourism hotspot. A lawsuit targets a whites-only settlement in northeast Arkansas, and more on the rise of a fatal disease targeting deer and elk populations. Those stories and more are coming up this week on the News Wrap from the Arkansas Newsroom. I'm Daniel Breen, News Director of Little Rock Public Radio. Each week, we're recapping the top stories from all across the natural state. We'll unpack the headlines, share exclusive insights, and provide the context you need to fully grasp the issues that matter most to Arkansans. That's this week on the Arkansas News Wrap, coming up right after the news from NPR. This is the Arkansas News Wrap. I'm Daniel Breen with Little Rock Public Radio. Fans of the Northwest Arkansas resort town of Eureka Springs typically associate it with one of a few things: hippies, bikers, the natural hot springs, and maybe the towering seven-story sculpture of Jesus known as the Christ of the Ozarks. Kaylee Cook is a first-year PhD student at Princeton University and completed her master's at the University of Missouri. She wrote her thesis about Eureka Springs' history, centering around the religious landmark. Last month, Cook won the James L. Foster and Billy W. Beeson Award from the Arkansas Historical Association for her work titled Big Jesus. KUAF's Jack Travis has more on Cook's award-winning research into Christian tourism and far-right influence in the Ozarks.
Eureka Springs has a storied past. What once began as a small settlement advertising the healing properties of spring waters flowing from the hills eventually transformed into a regional destination. And a little more than halfway through the 20th century, a man named Gerald Smith developed a hotspot for Christian tourism in the Ozark town, one that may look more at home in Rio de Janeiro. Historian Kaylee Cook wrote her master's thesis at the University of Missouri on the history of a 60-foot statue that locals call Big Jesus.
It refers to the Christ of the Ozarks statue in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. A notorious far-right figure named Gerald L.K. Smith built it there in 1966 and eventually expanded it into a large, successful Christian tourism enterprise.
She says this created a dilemma for local residents, because Smith had a reputation for hatred.
Though Christian tourism provided much-needed economic revival, it also required collaboration, or at least association, with a very hateful, controversial figure. This eventual compromise between local residents and the far right and their search for economic gain creates the stark juxtaposition still seen in Eureka Springs, a well-known bright blue dot in the Red Sea of the Ozarks.
Cook is from the Ozarks, on the Missouri side. She says the contrast of Eureka Springs' alternative reputation with its staunchly religious tourism attraction intrigued her.
I noticed that firsthand. I had traveled to Eureka Springs. I knew people there. Specifically, I knew people who were in like the metaphysical business there, who were very much involved in this sort of new age, countercultural, progressive hippiedom in Eureka Springs. And that made sense for the town. It didn't really make sense for the Ozarks to me. It stood out. And I think Eureka Springs stands out to a lot of folks for that reason. This sort of, it's been called like a gay Mecca or like an alternative oasis in the Ozarks. But those things make sense for the town when you're there. What didn't make sense was this big, stark white, 67-foot, boxy Jesus statue jutting out above town. And so as a person, I was very curious about that. As a historian, I knew that I could hopefully better contextualize what that is.
Christ of the Ozarks founder, Gerald Smith, was relatively unknown to Cook before she started digging deeper.
He is mentioned in histories of the far right, and histories of 1940s, 1950s politics. Before coming to Eureka Springs, he spent decades sort of building this far right fringe, what he calls the Christian Nationalist Crusade. He is really shunned by the mainstream. sort of kicked out to this pretty irrelevant place on the political sphere.
However, Smith wasn't just a right-leaning politician.
Yeah, Angelica Smith was a proud bigot, proud Christian nationalist. This was well known. This was his career. And people knew that. But economic incentive seems to have somehow allowed him this stage, this opportunity, this compromise.
After he builds the Christ of the Ozarks in 1966, he also starts live productions of The Great Passion Play, which is troublesome in its own right, as Smith added in his own brand of anti-Semitism.
He revises the script to really highlight these anti-Semitic tropes, but the show is very popular regardless. And interestingly, again, on this idea of compromise for local residents, many local residents are performing in the play.
During Gerald Smith's rise in Eureka, the area was becoming a place for people engaged in the Back to the Land movement and homesteading in the Ozark Hills. They were hippies from Smith's perspective, yet Cook says that these so-called hippies protested the passion play in the day, then they took to the stage at night.
Why on earth would they be willing to endorse, support, or at the very least, associate with a far-right figure who's notorious? It's not that they didn't know, they were very aware of his ideas and publications. He'd been very lambasted by the public. As you look at protest and pushback, you have to understand that it wasn't an easy compromise for most people, and it wasn't a desired outcome for most people, but it was seen as necessary to some for this economic revival. The Ozarks region was very impoverished, sparsely populated, late to be industrialized.
And although this was changing with the rise of Walmart, Tyson, and some major recreation projects across the region, Eureka still needed a boost. The city's first economic boom came from visitors searching for healing springs. So Cook says that tourism seemed like an easy way to revitalize the town.
So this makes sense for them. This makes sense. Again, besides the association, this seems like a necessary compromise. And a lot of the residents around Eureka Springs are living gig to gig. It's a very unsteady economy. And so Smith appears to be a really profitable addition to a lot of these weak streams of income, especially with the passion play, and they're taking up these roles. Hundreds of them are taking part in the play. And I've spoken with some of these people as I'm interviewing for this project. Many of them do not endorse Smith, at least now, or don't support him personally, but did really enjoy being in the passion play.
Cook says that we still see these compromises in modern-day Eureka Springs, but the Ozarks aren't unique. People all over the country make these kinds of compromises every day.
And I think that's one of the important parts of this project is the present day relevance, thinking about compromise, thinking about collaboration, thinking about what becomes mainstream and how easily it becomes mainstream if there's something to be gained or if the perception is that there's something to be gained. I don't think it's too surprising that I began this project in the fall of 2024 and was very interested to pinpoint what moral values otherwise progressive people were willing to forfeit in order to achieve perceived economic gain. So, what will you do if you think you'll have lower gas prices? What will you do if you think you'll have cheaper groceries? Those questions are really influencing my own thought process as I was considering these local residents.
Kaylee Cook won the Arkansas Historical Association's James L. Foster and Billy W. Beeson Award for her University of Missouri master's thesis, Big Jesus, Christian tourism, and far-right influence in the Arkansas Ozarks. You can visit our website, KUAF.com, to read the paper in its entirety, which Cook says she plans to publish.
That was KUAF's Jack Travis reporting. News of a whites-only compound being built in northeast Arkansas near Ravenden prompted headlines and condemnation last summer. Now a lawsuit has been filed seeking to shut it down for good. KUAF's Matthew Moore reports.
A federal discrimination lawsuit was filed last week in the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Arkansas against a whites-only community. The next day, Return to the Land co-founders Eric Orwall and Peter Sary went live on their Rumble page to talk about the New York Times article that broke the news and the lawsuit. Sary holds a printed out version of the story.
So according to the New York Times, last summer, Michelle Walker was watching the local 5 o'clock news in her St. Louis living room when a segment about a real estate opportunity caught her attention.
Michelle Walker is a St. Louis-based real estate broker and the named plaintiff in a lawsuit against Return to the Land. The suit was filed by Roman Colfax, the Legal Defense Fund, and Legal Aid of Arkansas, and argues that this whites-only community violates the Fair Housing Act at the federal and state level. Abigail Hertzfeld is a Fair Housing staff attorney for Legal Aid of Arkansas. She says the federal Fair Housing Act is a prominent element of the Civil Rights Act that passed after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
The Fair Housing Act was passed in particular to fight housing discrimination, and it really started as housing discrimination on the basis of race. And, you know, you can imagine why that would be a problem and would stop people from being able to live and feel safe in their homes.
Hertzfeld says Legal Aid's participation in the suit is to represent the state of Arkansas, and Return to the Land is also violating the Arkansas Fair Housing Act.
There are private club exceptions to the Arkansas Fair Housing Act and the Federal Fair Housing Act, but the private club exception only really applies to whenever the housing is like it's kind of like incidental to the primary purpose. So where we see this come up a lot is with sororities and fraternities. The private club exception, for example, would allow a sorority house to only have female identifying people live there, but we do not believe it applies in this case.
Sary says that's not actually the basis of their argument.
We've never relied on the private club exemptions from the Fair Housing Act, but there's probably a dozen news articles that claim that we do, and they try to make legal arguments for us, mm-hmm. which, I mean, doesn't make any sense unless they're trying to prejudice judges against us.
Right.
Orwall jumps in.
I mean, I might have mentioned that exception at one point, and then they take that and run with it.
Yeah, it's right. I mean, I've mentioned it in the past. It's certainly relevant, but it's not one that our structure relies upon.
Hertzfeld says it's important to recognize that the two leaders, Orwall and Sary, are not native Arkansans. Orwall is originally from La Mirada, California, just outside L.A. Sary is from Connecticut.
They chose Arkansas because they believe racial segregation is normal in Arkansas and that judges are on their side. And I really think that is important for Legal Aid to be involved for all Arkansans to know that, you know, you have someone here, you have a group of people who are fighting for your rights in housing and housing discrimination. And yes, we have national partners as well, and we are very thankful to, you know, have them help with the litigation efforts. But it's really important for us to stand up against this for everyone in Arkansas, because we know that's not true.
In the complaint, Walker says her application to purchase property in the Ravenden-based community was rejected because Return to the Land's founders is explicitly attempting to establish an all-white community. Walker is a Jewish woman married to a black man and has biracial children. She told the New York Times she was hoping to learn more about how renting out a home there would work, but she did not intend on moving her family to live there. Return to the Land posted on their Facebook page disputing what has been reported about them in several news outlets. They wrote that Walker didn't apply to purchase property. Instead, she applied to join an online membership association. One commenter asked why Walker was rejected. The group replied saying, quote, "Even if Ms. Walker and her entire family were European, she would likely have been denied for her political views. Return to the land certainly does not accept any liberals, end quote. The lawsuit names not only Return to the Land, but it also names the local chapter, the Arkansas-based LLC, and the five co-founders individually. Hirschfield says this is common practice for their work at Legal Aid, to not only include the LLC a landlord might run their rental business through, but to also name the landlords personally.
The rationale is that, you know, partly I like to kind of talk about vicarious liability sometimes. A lot of people are familiar with that, you know, that your employer is responsible for the acts of the employees. And so we just believe that everyone involved should be held liable for the discrimination.
Hirschfield says she has seen comments about how private individuals are not held accountable for housing discrimination or civil rights laws across the board.
And that is untrue. Everyone is held accountable to these housing laws. I mean, there are exceptions, of course, like every civil rights law, but there are never exceptions for race. And I think people just sometimes misunderstand their rights as private individuals, and they think some of these housing laws and civil rights laws may only apply to public individuals.
Walker's complaint is asking the court for an injunction to stop Return to the Land from engaging in further housing discrimination. She is also seeking for damages for, quote, emotional distress, humiliation, embarrassment, and pain and suffering. Return to the Land has had a fundraiser for their legal fees running since November 2024, which was about 18 months before a lawsuit was ever filed. The goal is set at $200,000. As of this recording, they have received more than $142,000 towards that goal, with more than 1,500 donors. Co-founders Orwell and Sari discuss back and forth in the Rumble video the consequences of this legal action. We hear first from Orwell.
We would obviously love the option to take it to trial if that was necessary. It's just that greatly increases the expense.
Of course.
And, well, and they would want a jury trial, because if they make it be a jury trial, then it's going to cost us a heck of a lot more.
Yep.
Obviously.
Yep.
So, I mean, their goal is to drain us basically financially.
The case has been assigned to U.S. District Judge D. Price Marshall Jr., and a date has not yet been set for the trial.
That was KUAF's Matthew Moore reporting. Chronic wasting disease is on the rise in deer and elk populations in Arkansas. Little Rock Public Radio's Nathan Treese spoke with the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission's wildlife health biologist, A.J. Riggs, to learn more about the state's response.
CWD is a neurological disease only in the cervidae family. So for Arkansas, that is elk and whitetails. It is a prion disease, so it's not something that's alive, so it can't be killed. It's a misformed protein, and once it starts misfolding, it has others misfold, and then that ultimately causes cell death, specifically, or more prominently, in the brain, literally making it look like Swiss cheese underneath a microscope. If an animal has CWD, there is no vaccine. Ultimately, that animal is going to die. We understand the transmission of prions can happen both through direct and indirect. Direct is, you know, obviously nose to nose, grooming through their feces, urine, and even in their blood, but then also indirect, which incorporates an environmental component where they're leaving those materials on the landscape, and then another deer's coming by and picking it up.
Tell me a little bit about then the risk factors. Like, what are we looking at in terms of the effects for the white-tailed deer population and things like that? What are we worried about?
Population declines. They have been documented in multiple species, and we here very recently just concluded a population impact study in three study areas in Newton and Searcy County, and have actually during the study itself, we actually saw the population of deer in those study areas decline to a current estimated 1.2 to 5 deer per square mile, which is extremely low. But ultimately, the bottom line is that there's not going to not be any deer on the landscape. there will just likely be less deer than most people want, and those deer will likely be younger than most people would prefer.
What do we need to know? What does the population need to know about how to identify it, what to do, so forth?
Well, the hardest thing about CWD is that the incubation period is so long. So everybody learned about incubation period when COVID hit the scene in 2020. And that's the period of time from when you actually contract the disease till you start showing symptoms. In whitetails, that is 12 to 18 months, potentially longer. And so during that time, that animal is sick. He or she is shedding the proteins into the environment and making contact with other animals. And so most people, 99% of the time, you can kill a positive animal and not know that it is positive just by looking at it. Because they don't have the significant kind of keystone symbols for having the disease until right at the very end, the last month or so. Those symptoms include not being scared of humans, having an A-frame stance, slobbering, urinating, sometimes doing all of that at the same time, but in a general kind of unawareness that life is going on around them. Sometimes we see them circling, not all the time. Sometimes they just lay and not move. So there's a variety of symptoms there, I guess you'd say, or clinical signs there. As a hunter, if you're hunting in an area that is known to have CWD, so now one of the 31 counties that are part of our CWD management zone, it is recommended that you have your animal tested and not consume that animal until you get the results back, and then not consume it if it's positive. That testing to our hunters is absolutely free. The easiest way to submit samples is through our CWD testing drop-off container network. There's 110 of those across the state. You can find where those are at agfc.com/CWD. Most of them are available 24 hours a day. Some aren't, so check that once hunting season gets a little bit closer. We have a network of taxidermists that also provide testing. If neither of those options work for you, then contact a regional office and a local biologist may be able to meet up and get a sample taken.
That was A.J. Riggs, wildlife health biologist with the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission, speaking with Little Rock Public Radio's Nathan Treese. And that's it for this week. The Arkansas News Wrap is brought to you by the Arkansas Newsroom, a collaboration between KUAF in Fayetteville, KASU in Jonesboro, and Little Rock Public Radio. You can find this week's episode on any of our station's websites. Until next time, I'm Daniel Breen, and this is the Arkansas News Wrap.